Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go.
Welcome to Saturday Frights, the podcast. I am your co-host, the projectionist. And now, for your host, Vic Sage.
Thank you, projectionist, and welcome back, friends, to the Saturday Frights podcast. For this show, we are going to be discussing the 1982 classic Poltergeist. In fact, it was 33 years ago today that the film was first released to theaters, not only scaring an entire generation of moviegoers, but forcing us to keep a sharp eye on our television sets in the middle of the night.
Yes! Although, are you sure it wasn't just you, Sage?
I'm pretty sure, but I certainly can tell you it frightened me when I first caught it at the 112 drive-in. At least certain scenes did. Poltergeist was released on June 4th, 1982, directed by... Well, friends, it's on record that Toby Hooper was the director for Poltergeist, but I personally feel that it was in fact directed by Steven Spielberg. More on that after the synopsis.
Here we go, dear listeners. Strap yourselves in for one of Victor's famous beat-by-beat story explanations.
The synopsis concerns the Freeling family, who live in the suburban community of Cuesta Verde. Stephen Freeling, played by Craig T. Nelson, is an accomplished real estate developer. His wife, Diane, played by Jo Beth Williams, is a stay-at-home mother, taking care of their three children. Teenager Dana, portrayed by the late Dominique Dunn, Robbie, played by Oliver Robbins, and Carol Ann, portrayed by the late Heather O'Rourke. One night, Stephen falls asleep in the living room, watching TV. Of course, back then, TV stations didn't run 24/7, and usually, a little after midnight, a station would go off the air, filling the picture tube with nothing but noisy static. The Freeling family are awoken by Carol Ann, who's very loudly talking to the TV, holding a conversation that only the little girl can hear the replies to. The next night, in Stephen and Diane's bedroom, Carol Ann is drawn to their TV. This time, however, a spectral hand emerges from the static-filled screen and blasts a small hole in the wall behind her parents' bed. This action also seems to cause a small earthquake, and once it dies down, Carol Ann turns to her parents and says the famous catchphrase, "They're here." From that point on, bizarre things begin to occur in the Freeling home. Chairs arrange themselves atop a table when Diane turns her back. The silverware is bent. The lights flare and dim, etc. Small things to be sure, but the supernatural phenomenon continues to ramp up, coming to a head on a stormy night when the ancient tree outside Robbie and Carol Ann's room literally tries to eat the young boy. This is all a ruse, however. While the family are trying to rescue Robbie, Carol Ann is abducted by supernatural forces. The Freelings search frantically throughout the house for the little girl, horrified when Robbie calls for them in the living room because Carol Ann's voice is coming from the static-filled TV now. Looking for help, the Freelings turn to three parapsychologists from the University of California. What the trio of scientists experience in the Freeling home pales even their already impressive encounters with the supernatural. Nightmarish hallucinations and even a physical attack lead the scientists to believe there isn't just one spirit causing the mayhem, but a legion. So a specialist is brought in, a spiritual medium named Tangina Behrens, played superbly by the late great Zelda Rubinstein. With her help, and two of the parapsychologists, as well as Stephen and Diane, they are able to rescue Carol Ann from what Tangina calls the Beast, a malign force that took the young girl into another dimension, using her to keep the spirits of the dead under its control. Though this isn't the end of the Freelings' hardships, they are moving out of the house, and can you blame them after what they experienced? On their last evening, while Stephen is out with his boss, Dana is out on a date, leaving Diane and the children alone, where they are attacked by the Beast, who obviously is upset that Carol Ann was rescued. Diane is able to get the children and escape the house, but all heck is breaking loose. Coffins and corpses are erupting out of the ground in an attempt to block their escape. Stephen arrives home in the nick of time and realizes the reasons for the disturbances are because when building Cuesta Verde, which was originally a cemetery, his boss moved the headstones, but to save money, he left the bodies. The Freeling home, as well as the others in the neighborhood, were built on a burial ground. Packing into the family station wagon, luckily Dana arrives to be included, the Freelings tear off down the street, abandoning Cuesta Verde and leaving their home behind. Though seconds later, the house implodes as it's dragged into another dimension by the angry spirits. That, my friends, is the synopsis for Poltergeist.
Wait, that's it? You didn't take up the whole show with your synopsis? That was like 3 minutes!
That's it. A full yet brief synopsis.
I don't know what to say, Victor.
That would be a first, projectionist. Before we jump into the notable cast and crew, as well as the trivia we have for the film, I'd like to share my own personal experiences with this film.
Certainly.
As I've already mentioned, I caught this at the 112 drive-in when it was originally released in my neck of the woods. Though I didn't get to see it the first weekend it opened, which gave my father a whole week of hearing how scary the movie was from his fellow co-workers. My father was totally on the fence about taking me to see it. I was 10 at the time, and while I had seen an enormous amount of horror films by that point, what his friends were telling him had him concerned.
It was a PG film, if I remember correctly.
True. It would be 2 years later that Gremlins in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom would cause the creation of the PG-13 rating. Ironic that Steven Spielberg had a hand in both films. There is a shocking amount of gore and supernatural frights for a PG film in Poltergeist. I mean, in one memorable scene, one of the parapsychologists, Marty, played by Martin Casella, is made to believe he's pulling chunks of flesh off of his face during a hallucination brought on by the spirits in the house. That scene takes place in a bathroom with Marty looking on in horror at a mirror as he reaches up to pull the flesh off his face, continuing to snatch chunks of his skin off even to the point where we can see his skull underneath. Those hands reaching up to claw at the flesh belong to none other than Steven Spielberg, by the way. It scares Marty so bad that he leaves the investigation, which is why I said only two of the parapsychologists end up helping Steven and Diane, the third being Ryan, played by Richard Lawson. Poltergeist did originally receive an R rating after being submitted, but the filmmakers fought the ruling and it was changed to a PG rating.
That was indeed a rather gruesome scene.
I didn't have any problems with that moment in the film. It was Robbie's clown doll that caused me the most concern. I'm getting a little ahead of myself, however. I kept telling my father that I wanted to see Poltergeist. He patiently explained his concerns, but I was dead set on seeing the movie. So my father gave me an ultimatum. If that weekend we saw the film, I would have to sleep alone in my bedroom.
So? What was so horrible about that?
Let me briefly explain the situation to you, projectionist, and the listeners. In my youth, I was terribly afraid of the dark. Couldn't stand it. And to be honest, even at 10, I was uncomfortable being alone in my bedroom. Particularly since my father let slip that the previous owner had died in that room. So I would sleep in the living room on our couch, falling asleep watching TV. So to see Poltergeist, I would have to brave the darkness of my bedroom, and maybe worst of all, have no entertainment to lull me to sleep.
Wait a minute, Sage. You're telling me your father chose for your bedroom the place where the previous owner of your home died in? I like your father already.
Listeners, you might think my father was pulling my leg, but my grandparents sadly confirmed his story. Now, both my father and I loved Poltergeist, and judging by the screams and laughter coming from the other families in their cars, we weren't the only one. Still, my young psyche was assaulted by probably one of the most memorable moments in the movie, when Robbie is attacked viciously by his possessed clown doll, its long cloth arms growing ridiculously long, wrapping around the young boy's throat, strangling him. All the while, a rictus grin is plastered on its face, and it's laughing evilly. As the film ended, I began to worry about going home, knowing that waiting in my own bedroom was, until that night, a cherished ventriloquist dummy, a reproduction of Edgar Bergen's famous Mortimer Snerd that I've talked quite a bit about on the Retroist and on our podcast. My father wasn't going to let me weasel out of our agreement, however. So after securing Mortimer in the toy box in my bedroom closet, it was time to go to sleep. Except, wouldn't you know it? First, I heard a low rumble of thunder, and as the storm moved in, I was frightened by the sound of something heavy falling in the closet. Was this it? Would I turn my head to see Mortimer slowly opening the closet door? Thankfully, I wouldn't find out, because by that point, my father had fallen asleep. I could hear his snoring next door, so I grabbed my Lone Ranger blanket and headed into the living room and fell asleep on the couch.
Oh my! How did you ever stand horror films with such a vivid imagination?
Projectionist, being frightened is why I love horror movies so much. That hour and a half or 2 hours of feeling scared, then when the credits roll, you walk out of the auditorium and it goes away. Mostly. That's the problem with dolls for me. That fear doesn't go away. It lingers and waits.
Tweezles, the clown, and the tree attack were in the film, as those were two very real fears from Steven Spielberg.
That's enough about my experiences with the film. How did Poltergeist play at the Starlight, the Haunted Drive-In?
Oh, quite well. It was the first feature for 5 weeks running.
Just a week after Poltergeist opened, Spielberg had another mega hit on his hands, as on June 11th, E.T. the Extraterrestrial opened in theaters. In fact, Universal Studios, which was releasing E.T., had a stipulation in Spielberg's contract that he couldn't direct another film while working on the Extraterrestrial.
Which is why Toby Hooper was brought on board to helm Poltergeist, dear listeners.
Yeah, but... And yet again, this is just my personal opinion, but I truly believe that Steven Spielberg was the one who directed Poltergeist. Everything about that movie screams Spielberg. I've seen plenty of Toby Hooper's work. The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Salem's Lot, The Funhouse, Life Force, and his remake of Invaders from Mars. None of it looks like Poltergeist looks.
No, Sage. Frank Marshall, the co-producer of Poltergeist, went on record as saying the creative force was Steven. Toby was the director and was on set every day. But Steven did the design for every storyboard, and he was on the set every day except for 3 days when he was in Hawaii with Lucas.
He was referring to George Lucas, of course. But Spielberg has also gone on record stating, quote, Toby isn't a take charge sort of guy. If a question was asked and an answer wasn't immediately forthcoming, I'd jump in and say what we could do. Toby would not agreement, and that became the process of collaboration, end quote. Even back in 1982, people were wondering who truly the director was for the film. The Directors Guild of America opened up an investigation, which led Spielberg, having an open letter published in The Hollywood Reporter, directed towards Toby, saying, quote, regrettably, some of the press has misunderstood the rather unique creative relationship which you and I shared throughout the making of Poltergeist. I enjoyed your openness in allowing me a wide berth for creative involvement, just as I know you were happy with the freedom you had to direct Poltergeist so wonderfully. Through the screenplay, you accepted a vision of this very intense movie from the start. And as the director, you delivered the goods. You performed responsibly and professionally throughout, and I wish you a great success on your next project. End quote.
I suppose we will never know the true answer, Victor.
Perhaps. But some of the cast and members of the crew swear Spielberg was doing everything, while some others claim it was Hooper in the director's chair for the entire shoot.
Exactly. It's a case of he said, she said.
I've got one more thing to share here. In an interview with Quint over at Ain't It Cool News, actress Zelda Rubinstein said Steven directed all 6 days that she was on the set. Quote, Toby set up the shots and Steven made the adjustments, end quote. She also hinted that Hooper, quote, allowed some unacceptable chemical agents into his work, end quote. Friends, please let me be clear here. I'm not mentioning this as an attack against Toby Hooper. I like a lot of his films. I mentioned what Rubinstein said, only to point that maybe Spielberg was forced to direct the film. I'll include a link in the show notes of the podcast post and let you read the interview for yourself.
Let us change the subject then, shall we?
Yeah, that's probably a good idea. Poltergeist was written by Steven Spielberg, as well as by Michael Grace and Mark Victor. Poltergeist is more than just a horror film, of course. A lot of its magic comes from that typical Spielberg family archetype, but I've always been most impressed by how powerful the female leads are.
Yes. Stephen Freeling is a bit of a bumbler.
I don't know if I would say he's a bumbler, but in the end it's the female characters like Diane, the parapsychologist Dr. Lesh, played by Beatrice Straight, and of course Tangina, who not only form an unbreakable bond, standing strong against the dangers of the beast, but in Diane's case, understandably, her overwhelming love for her daughter gives her the strength to enter another dimension to bring Carol Ann safely back. Stephen almost ruins everything when he panics. Refusing to listen to Tangina, he's holding the rope, which is tied to Diane, acting as her anchor, so to speak. The medium is conversing with the spirits of the dead.
Yes, about that scene. What did you feel was her goal in that moment, Sage?
Tangina was freeing the spirits of the dead that were being falsely led by the beast. It was using Carol Ann's life force as a beacon to these lost souls, using the gathered spirits to cause the supernatural occurrences in the house.
So the medium was trying to lessen the hold of the beast.
Exactly. Like I was saying, though, Stephen, while understandably questioning what Tangina is saying to the lost souls, shows a resounding lack of faith in the medium, and his wife when you get down to it, yanking on the rope to pull Diane back through their end of the portal to the other dimension, which causes the beast to show its displeasure, with an enormous rotting face covered completely in a blue flame, pushing itself through the portal from the closet door to roar its disapproval at the man.
I can still remember the screams from the patrons of the haunted drive-in during that scene.
Was that in their cars or the basement of the concession stand?
What? What did you say?
Oh, just that it was a scary moment. Heather O'Rourke really knocked it out of the ballpark with her performance as Carol Ann. A real mixture of sweetness and being mischief that is captured by the camera. She wasn't the first choice, however, for the role. It was Drew Barrymore that was being considered for the part, but Stephen wanted someone a little more angelic. Barrymore's audition, however, landed her the role as Gertie in E.T.
Didn't you share a photograph of the kids from both films with Steven Spielberg playing over at the Retroist?
I did. It's a behind-the-scenes shot of them on the set, actually. The filming locations for each film were a mere 20 minutes away from each other. I'll be sure to include a link to that photo in the show notes. With all of the gruesome effects on display in Poltergeist, the most shocking ones turned out to be quite real. The skeletons that bob up like demented apples in the pool attack scene were real human skeletons. It was cheaper to purchase the real thing than manufacture fake versions.
Indeed. In that very scene, Jo Beth Williams became nervous. Not of the skeletons, but of all the lighting equipment on set hanging over the pool that she was submerged in. To help ease her fears, Steven Spielberg himself joined Jo Beth Williams in the water, remarking that, "Now if a light falls in, we'll both fry."
I have to go on record as saying that statement wouldn't have made me feel much better. You might think that Heather O'Rourke would have been a little unnerved by all of the effects on the set, but it turns out she only got scared at one moment while filming. During her character's abduction by the beast, the actress had to hold onto a headboard while everything is getting sucked into the portal to the other dimension, an effect achieved by using a giant wind fan to blow toys and objects into the closet. Perhaps Heather was worried she was going to be sucked into the fan herself. I'm not sure, but she apparently broke down while filming that moment. Spielberg halted the filming, picked her up, and held her in his arms, promising that she didn't have to film any more of that scene. I think we should also mention the incredible score for Poltergeist by Jerry Goldsmith, in particular, Carol Ann's theme.
Thank you.
Jerry Goldsmith's work was nominated for an Academy Award, but he lost a John Williams score for E.T. the Extraterrestrial. The soundtrack for Poltergeist wasn't available for almost 15 years after the film, until 1997, when Rhino Movie Music released the CD. Although a two-disc set was made available on December 9th, 2010 by Film Score Monthly.
We should also add for the listeners that originally there was to be lyrics that accompanied Carol Ann's theme, Victor.
True. The lyrics were written by John Bettis, but dropped during the final mix. A few of those lyrics read, "As evening shadows crawl deep and long, reaching across the bed, mother and father hear children's prayers now as they bow their heads. Bless this house, and the souls within, through the night till it's light again. Light our hearts through the dark to the breaking day. Bless this house, we pray." You can find a complete list of lyrics at Jerry Goldsmith Online, which I'll include a link to on the post. Projectionist, it looks like our time's about up. Do you have anything else you'd like to add?
We have much more trivia to discuss, Sage. But due to time constraints, you should share the notable cast and crew, eh?
Oh, I almost forgot, actually. Thank you. I don't believe I need to go into further detail on the many films that Spielberg has crafted, and earlier I gave a good list of work that Tobe Hooper was connected with as a director, so let's jump straight to the cast. Jo Beth Williams has 106 acting credits to her name, with notable appearances in film and TV, including 1979's Kramer vs. Kramer, 1980's Stir Crazy, 1983's The Day After, and of course, the 1986 sequel to Poltergeist, Poltergeist 2: The Other Side. Craig T. Nelson has earned 82 acting credits with notable roles in 1979's Injustice for All, 1980's Where the Buffalo Roam, and in that same year, Private Benjamin, as well as also being cast in Stir Crazy, 1983's All the Right Moves, and 1986's Poltergeist 2. He might be best known for his role on TV, though, as Coach Hayden Fox in the hit series Coach, a role he played for 198 episodes. Oliver Robbins has only 7 acting credits, but they include appearances in 1982's TV movie Don't Go to Sleep, Airplane 2, the sequel, and the segment Monsters from the 1986 Twilight Zone revival. Friends, I don't want to go into the details of the passing of Dominique Dunn and Heather O'Rourke. I hope you'll understand. Dominique Dunn had earned 13 acting credits with notable roles in Fame, Heart to Heart, Chips, Hill Street Blues, and in the TV movie The Shadow Riders, where she co-starred with the likes of Tom Selleck, Sam Elliott, the legendary Ben Johnson, and Jeffrey Lewis. Heather O'Rourke had 15 acting credits with notable appearances in 1981's Fantasy Island, Chips, 12 episodes of Happy Days as Heather Pfister, 1983's Webster as Melody, 1986 Poltergeist 2, as well as 1988's Poltergeist 3. Zelda Rubinstein had 55 acting credits to her name at the time of her passing on January 27, 2010. She got something of a late start in acting, as Poltergeist was only her 4th credit, the previous 3 being 1979's Americathon and 1980's The Flintstone Comedy Show, where she provided the voice of Atrocia Frankenstone, and 1981's underappreciated comedy Under the Rainbow. Other notable roles include 1984's 16 Candles, 1986 Poltergeist 2, 1987's Anguish, 1988's Poltergeist 3, 1992's Picket Fences for 44 episodes, 1996's Little Witches, and 2006's Behind the Mask, The Rise of Leslie Vernon. I think that about wraps it up for this episode, friends. On behalf of the Projectionist and myself, we thank you for listening to the Saturday Frights podcast. If you did enjoy the show, we hope you will hop on over to The Retroist every Saturday, where we present everything from classic horror TV shows to the best in frightening shorts. The music you hear on the show was provided by Peachy. If you'd like to contact him, you may do so at peachy@retroist.com. That is P-E-A-C-H-Y @retroist.com. Of course, I have to give thanks for the invaluable feedback to my co-host, The Projectionist. Where can your fans find you if they wish to contact you?
I do not care for current technological standards, but I am sometimes on the Facebooks. Projectionist, Haunted Drive-In.
We have a Saturday Frights Facebook page as well. We would greatly appreciate it if you could stop by and give us a like, or even let others know about it. It's another spot where we can share our love of retro horror with you and not have to wait until Saturday to do so. Our podcast is available on iTunes and Stitcher, and we would certainly appreciate it if you could click subscribe. Maybe even leave us a nice review if you are pleased with our work. It really does help us reach new audience members. I can be found nearly every day on The Retroist. If you have any suggestions for future shows or even feedback, you can contact me at vicsage@retroist.com. We owe a great debt of gratitude to The Retroist himself for not only allowing us to record here in The Retroist Vault, but hosting the podcast as well. When you have retro needs, and we all do, just head over to www.retroist.com. Until next time, the vault is sealed.
Moved the cemetery, but you left the bodies, didn't you? You only moved the headstones! Why?
Why? This has been a Retroist production. Goodbye.